Salam and welcome to Stray Reflections. I'm your host, Shoaib. Today, I have here with me a historian, a content creator, a narrator. He's founder of the YouTube channel, Al-Muqaddima.
But you chose specifically Islamic history. And you do understand that like there is so much controversy surrounding Islamic history. And it's a very, especially like in the current atmosphere, it's not an easy topic to talk about. Why did you do that? And how careful you are talking about this kind of stuff?
I think that I was personally very surprised by how I was expecting it to be very controversial. But it's actually not all that controversial. I think that usually we live in Pakistan and all that, you know, the educated liberal kind of people, we don't give enough credit to our fellow Muslims. People are pretty open about that. I think that to a large extent, I get more comments about people who are like telling me how brave I am or how controversial the topics are than I get about people saying X, Y, and Z. For example, in my recent video on homosexuality, I got like basically three kinds of responses. One was from LGBT Muslims who wrote me a lot of emails telling me about how their experiences have been and how they're sort of reinterpreting Quran's teachings on homosexuality and how they're trying to reconcile their faith with their sexual identity. And then there were comments about like I said, people being like, yeah, this is going to be controversial. One person was even telling me to stay out of countries like Afghanistan and basically the entire East. And then there were comments by Muslims, not so threatening, but more like, this is haram or something like that. Yeah, they weren't exactly threatening, but like people were trying to argue or people were trying to just say that, yeah, this is haram. You have covered it, but yeah, it's haram and stuff like that. But yeah, still, I decided that maybe it's time that we took a look at the secular interpretation of our history. We've let our history be represented for too long by the clergy and sort of this ideology, you know, our history. I think in the East, we tend to usually look at history through the lens of some kind of ideology, be it religion or whatever other kind of ideology it be. So I thought that it was time to do that. And I think the response has been pretty good so far. I have...
Okay, well, we'll get to Hagia Sophia and the Armenian genocide by the Ottoman Empire like later on. But like... So as you have done like plenty of research on history, do you find this thing which Dr. Harari called actually the historian's dilemma, that when you look at history, you find so many simplistic explanations of the historical events. But as you dig deep and you go in the depth, you find that there is so much contradictory information. And after getting that information, you are usually even unsure of yourself, uncertain of yourself.
You get bombarded by so much information that it's just difficult to make sense of things. And I think that I've recently been reading a book about that called In Defense of History by, I think, Richard Evans is his name. I've been reading the book and I think that there's no such thing as objective truth, that even if two people were witnessing the same event, they could write, even for a lot of battles, we don't actually know who won. And so like perspective is a lot that matters. And so the idea of an unbiased historian, at least for me, and I think I'm in good company when I say that, does not really exist, that historians have to be biased. They have to have, and they should talk openly about their biases, that I'm presenting this history from this perspective. In general, yes, a lot of, especially about the first century of Islam. That has been like, since we have very little information about that outside Islamic sources, that has pretty much been up for grabs since the 60s and 70s. People have been trying to, for lack of a better term, reinvent the wheel there, because there are people who say, start things from like, some people claim that the Prophet, peace be upon him, was Jewish. And some people say that Mecca was not the city that that the prophet was born in, the prophet spent most of his life in, like a lot of other interesting things that have been like they're in sort of the revisionist circles. So it's very difficult to talk about, like to explain why I believe certain things that I believe. And I think that's true for a lot of historians because of so many facts that you get sometimes, that so many sides are arguing with each other, that you just sort of, I think, as far as I think, arbitrarily choose a side. A lot of historians, I think, do that.
But do you think, like, there's so many scholars like who argue this point, like, I mean, they have a different, they have a difference of opinion on this matter as well. There is no clear political structure in Islam, that whether it should be a caliphate, whether it should be a democracy or anything. Well, there are so many people there. There's like Ghamdi, like who says like it is supposed to be Islam. The Quran actually says that you have to rule by consultation, and this is the basic principle which has been laid down by Quran. But there is no clear political structure, and like so many other, like even the extremist movements, like they say, okay, we have to revive the caliphate, and it is the only Islamic way. What do you think? Like this lack of political structure was the beginning of that the whole thing which happened afterward, the first fitna, the second fitna, and afterwards.
Yeah, this lack of actual. There were two main problems with this. At this point, that when Muawiyah was the first man to actually rule the caliphate, he is what Hugh Kennedy calls, he established the executive caliphate. Before this, Umar had just expanded the empire, and Uthman hadn't really done it that much, and then Ali had spent most of his time in civil war, and Muawiyah was the first person to actually rule the empire. During his time, he actually started to mint his own coinage, but that failed because look at this empire that he was ruling. It was half Byzantine, formerly Byzantine, and half formerly Sasanian. And these people, these two empires that had so much pride in their culture, their scientific achievements, everything, they were not going to accept these desert nomads come in and just try to replace things. And so Muawiyah tried to establish his own coinage, but that failed. They did not want to use coinage. The Byzantines, they wanted to use coinage with the image, with the cross on it, you know, Christian imagery on it. And the Sasanians, the Persians, they wanted to use coins with like images of Khosrow and other famous Iranian kings on them. So that's my point is that first, Islam did not have actual structures of how to rule, which is very surprising considering that the prophet spent like 11 years as essentially a ruler. But there wasn't all that much about how to rule, how to establish a government, how to regulate succession, stuff like that. But also, even if there was, these Byzantine and Persian people, they were not going to accept that. So the Muslims would have had to borrow heavily from their cultures in order to be able to rule them. Otherwise, they would just reject that. There could be revolts. There could be a lot of things, which is why Muawiyah, like he turned the caliphate into the executive caliphate, because he knew that otherwise this caliphate would not actually last very long. So yeah, that was primarily these two problems that led to that. But I think in the modern era, I think the caliphate is like, it's not really defined. Caliph just means successor or deputy. In this case, we mean successor or deputy to the prophet. But democracy, should it be democracy? Should it be autocracy? Should it be theocracy? We don't really know. And I think everybody tries to fill that void with whatever they think is best. Like if we bring back caliphate today, who would be the caliph? Who is somebody that all Muslims would agree on? Yeah, this is a good person. Let's choose him.
Probably Muhammad bin Salman.
If that happens, I am going to turn my channel into a total anti-caliphate propaganda machine.
Yeah, but there is another thing to this argument is as well, like Christianity, it evolved over time. Like there was a reformation by Martin Luther in Christianity, and nothing similar, kind of similar, happened to Islam. Like there is no high pope, the concept of high pope in Islam. So supposedly there is a religious scholar in Cairo, in Egypt. And like tomorrow he has like hundreds of thousands of followers, and he says something totally new, which has not existed in the religion. And he has every right to do that, because like there is no central authority which would challenge that. But in Christianity or in Roman Catholics, okay, they have a high pope like who can like who is like an authority on the matter. But in Islam, like it was supposed to be a democratic religion, do you think? And it became its weakness. What do you think about that?
In terms of being a democratic religion, that's a little bit true. I think that I agree with that because, you know, you have the concept of ijma. But then again, that power mostly resided with clergy. But luckily, anybody can become clergy. You just have to study enough and you can become a member of the clergy. So I think that, yes, it was more democratic. But in terms of Protestantism, for example, despite the fact that there was a pope, despite the fact that that pope had an army, other interpretations of Christianity did become commonplace. And that also happened in Islam. When you look at, for example, in let's say in the year 929, you are standing in Baghdad, you have a very different interpretation here. You have a very different interpretation in Cairo, in under the Fatimids. And then you have further still different in Andalus under Abdurrahman III. So I think that it was supposed to be this sort of difference. I don't know if it was supposed to be, but it was inevitable that this kind of difference was going to exist. And the reason that I think Islam did not see a reformation is because when it was sort of our time to see a reformation, we became so obsessed with a problem that we had to deal with, the external threat of colonialism. When Muslims became aware all of a sudden that they had declined in 1798 when Napoleon attacked Egypt, at that point there was thought about reformation, but the reformation could have been sort of a Western style reformation, but it wasn't because West was the enemy at the time. How could we take their ideas? How could we take democracy and secularism and all these different ideas? How could we were trying to push them out. And even today, like in Pakistan, you see this in Pakistan very clearly, that people push out Western ideas, even good ones, as Western imperialism, as sort of an extent of colonialism. So I think that over time, I'm pretty sure that with like, for example, you're already actually seeing that, I think, with Gandhi Saab or with the engineer Muhammad Ali Mirza being famous these days. They have found platforms through the internet, and the internet is doing for us what the printing press did for the Protestant movement. So I think that it's going to change. Now we will see a reform. We are seeing more and more people aligning themselves with these moderate people rather than and like moving away from. I mean, of course, at this time, Khatm-e-Nubuwwat and Rizvi and all these people can pull up a huge crowd. But I think that eventually, slowly, internet will enable us to meet new interpretations, and the power of this older clergy will decline.
Do you think this would be a reformation of the religious doctrine, or would it be just a reformation of the society? I mean, as we see in the Western, like the Western Europe right now, there is, I mean, certainly Christianity and the churches, but like the society overall has become like non-religious. That they don't care about like those Christian laws and Christian and the doctrine of Christianity, and the society has become like non-religious.
But at the same time, you see that non-religiousness has had an impact on Christianity as well. Christianity has become more soft-spoken, if you will. They're more lenient about allowing people in. They've become sort of like that. I think that both things will happen at the same time, that we will get more modern, moderate interpretations and people will move away from religion. Like we talked about homosexuality before. People have been like, there was this one person whom I think is more Muslim than I am. and he was, or at least they, I don't really know about their preferred pronouns. So they emailed me and they told me about that they're LGBT, they're homosexual. And at the same time, they're very religious and they're trying to find a way to reconcile Islam and homosexuality. And they've sort of reinterpreted the part of in the Quran about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. They're interpreting that as not being because of homosexuality, but because of their culture of rape. So I think that both a moderate interpretation and the non-religious thing is going to happen. But I think the one thing that I really hope does not happen is that, like in the West, you see people, while people are not Christian anymore, they do have a lot of Christian civilization left in them. I hope that happens to us too, that We choose to at least culturally remain Muslim, ethnically or in some ways, that even if we're not very religious, we do still continue to identify with this Islamic civilization, and we don't drop our Eastern Islamic identity for like a Western identity. I hope that we don't start naming our children John and Steve and all that. So,
no, absolutely not.
Yeah.
What do you think was the biggest reason? I was talking to Dr. Houd Bhai in the first episode, and I asked a similar question to him as well. That he was saying, like, he also wrote like one of the articles as well, that it was actually the lack of the intellectual curiosity which was the reason of the decline of these two magnificent empires, the Ottomans and the Mughals in Hindustan.
He also blamed Al-Ghazali for that. That's a point that I very strongly disagree with.
Okay, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that first, and then we can come back to this thing as well.
Okay, I don't think that intellectual curiosity, I think, exists in every civilization. But there were a couple of problems. And this is a very contemporary problem as well. When you look at, for example, Spain, you see that when Spain became vulnerable to Christian attacks, Al-Andalus became vulnerable to Christian attacks, people started to leave. And they started to leave and they moved to Morocco and Tunisia. And actually there, we saw a small golden age. We actually saw people who were able, who were developing things, who were building things, who were doing research. And they were actually able to defeat the giant Portuguese empire. They were, a king of Portugal died in Morocco. They were also, when lithographic printing came together, they were also very quick to adopt that. So we did saw, but I don't know why we don't give them enough credit for that. We did see a little golden age there. Similarly, when the Mongols attacked, they killed so many people for 200 years. You can see that for 200 years, we are seeing conqueror after conqueror coming in and destroying important cities. In 1350, Damascus and Baghdad were the world's capitals in printing, in making paper. Every single sheet of paper that was being used in Europe was being built, it was being produced in either Damascus or Baghdad. But then Timur came along and he burned both these cities. So we had, for 200 years, we had infrastructural decline, complete infrastructural decline, population decline. And then we also had the Black Death during this period. So overall, this huge 200-300 years of instability led to this problem. You can blame Al-Ghazali if you want, but Al-Ghazali was not as influential as we want to think that he was. He died, I think, in 1061 or so. But then for 200 years after that, we did see the Golden Age existing. And then we did see it sort of coming back in smaller portions in Morocco, in to some extent India, and in the Ottoman Empire. So we did see it. Al-Ghazali was not as influential as a lot of people like to think that he was. Secondly, what was the second point? I forgot. Anyhow.
Okay. No, like the one thing I would like to say here as well, like the sack of Baghdad, it was the biggest massacre in human history till the siege of Stalingrad by the Nazis.
Yeah, something like that. Like the numbers are not sure. We don't really have actual numbers, so we can say something like that.
Yeah, I mean, like it's also like legends and myths as well that
a lot of them.
Books like in the river, and the river of the Euphrates became actually like black ink from that from those books.
Yeah, the scale of the massacre was by no means small, and the infrastructural damage that it did. For example, the rivers were the canals that fed most of the area around Iraq were destroyed, and there was no. You can imagine how agriculture. This was a region that was sort of the breadbasket of the Middle East, and then all of a sudden there was no agriculture there. So a lot of things contributed to this. This was a horrible time to exist in the Islamic world. And then the Turks came along with the Mughals in India and Safavids. Well, Safavids were not exactly Turks, but them in Iran. And then they did not focus on universities, building universities. I don't know why exactly that was. I mean, with printing press, we know that they were, first of all, they thought that they had no need for a printing press. And secondly, the religious establishment and the other political establishment was scared that, you know, they had seen the Protestant Reformation in Europe, and they were afraid that something like that might happen in the Islamic world. And, you know, the powerful people, they were afraid of losing power. So that's one of the reasons. But I think that maybe the printing press would have been could have contributed to it. Obviously, it did contribute. But what I don't understand is why no universities. We did see universities being built before the civilization under siege era. I really don't know why there were no universities being built. I have no idea why that is. I'm trying to understand that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's this thing also, like over there, like in history, people usually mention like one or two events as like the watershed moments or like the turning points of the history. As a historian, what do you think about that? Like, so I will like mention here like two specific events like in history, like one like Charles Martel and the Battle of Tours in 732. Mm-hmm. Christian historians, they call him the savior of Western civilization and Christianity. And there is another event like the Battle of Anjalut, which like so many people say saved Islam when Mamluks fought against the Mongols. What do you think about this?
Both of those events, I think watershed moments hardly ever come down to one battle. In terms of Anjalut, there was no way that the Mongols could have actually attacked Egypt. They could have actually like attacked Egypt, but they wouldn't have been able to conquer Egypt. When the Mongols, when Hulagu Khan came to attack Baghdad, he had 100,000 soldiers, and every soldier had like two or three horses with him, which like he was to ride one and then eat the rest on his journey. This army of 300 or 400,000 people, wherever they went, they changed ecosystems there. You know, they fed on so much grass and so much land that they just changed. You know, imagine such a huge caravan traveling. And the problem was that after Baghdad, they would have had trouble attacking Egypt because they would have had to cross this huge desert. And any army that was large enough to, that was small enough to cross the desert would not have been able to face the Mamluks. So it is, it's not that the battle itself changed too much, but rather the battle marks a point that was the first point, was the beginning of the end for the Mongols, basically, you could say. And same for Tor. Tor did not itself change as much as we think it did, but it marks a point with the rise of the Carolingians in France and the sort of the beginning of the end for the Umayyads. If the Muslims had won at Tor, it's likely that Charles Martel would have died. And so we would not have had Charlemagne. You know, European history would have been very different. Mm-hmm. But would the Muslims have been able to control it? I don't think so. If you've been to like southern France, you don't see any semblance of any Islamic civilization there. Narbonne was under Islamic control for something like 50 years. Aquitaine, most of Aquitaine was under Islamic control for like 50 years. But we don't see any semblance there because the Muslims would not have been able to hold on to that region. Muslims were not able to hold on to Italy. Muslims were not able to hold on to Switzerland. This part of Europe, they simply could not have been able to hold on to. So I don't think that European history would have been like, it would have been different, but I don't think that it would have been Muslim today. Like Edward Gibbon says that we would be teaching the Quran in Oxford today if the Muslims had won the Battle of Tor. That really would not have happened. Edward Gibbon is exaggerating the importance of that battle very much.
No, but like you mentioned this one point, like historical revisionism, and there is something similar going on in India right now.
Mm-hmm.
That they are trying to like rename the cities, that Allahabad is not Allahabad anymore and it's Prayagraj. I think I correctly Prayagraj, and like they are trying to change the name of some other cities. There is Aurangabad, and they are trying to like rebuild some of their lost temples that supposedly some Muslims built mosque upon.
Yes.
What do you think about that? Like, is that not like historical revisionism?
That is very much a historical revision. Like I said, that we're still guilty of that. I think Europeans are not as guilty of that anymore. But about India is, it truly is a tragedy what is happening there. I think of India as sort of our cousin, and I think of it as the only actual secular democracy to exist in the formerly colonized world, and to see it fall is truly a tragedy to my heart. And the, yeah, the revisionism they're being painted. Aurangzeb is now simply just the bad guy. He is just the bad guy. And a couple of years ago, Akbar was actually sort of a good guy, the good Muslim. But now he's not that anymore. Babur is this child rapist who destroyed mosques and all that, temples and all that. So yeah, historical revisionism in a horrible degree is happening there. And it's less about history, like I said, that we tend to look at history too much, too often from an ideology perspective, and that's what's happening there. Like a lot of liberals, even they have, the right wing has bombarded people with so much propaganda that some points have been conceded. Like even the most liberal Hindus now genuinely believe that Alauddin Khilji attacked the Nalanda University and destroyed the so-called Indian Golden Age, and that Mahmud of Ghazni attacked Somnath Mandir and then took it and all that wealth and stuff like that. So people genuinely believe that, because even liberals, people who don't support the BJP, they agree to that, this sort of revisionism. And with all these Bollywood movies and all this, it truly is terrible what's happening there.
I mean, they are doing like a proper like propaganda. Like, I haven't watched any of those movies, but like I've heard about it like from some friends, and like recently they made a movie on Prithviraj Chauhan.
Touch on, yes.
Before that, they made a movie about against like Alauddin Khilji. Like
Yes, Padmavat.
what was the name of that?
Padmavat.
Yeah, Padmavat. Yeah, exactly. But okay, let me rephrase this question as like in a different perspective. So we come from Pakistan, and there are so many Muslims who are living in India as well, like, or the Muslims of India, or historically the Muslims of Hindustan. So like we are actually the people of this region, the Indian subcontinent historically. And then there comes like invaders, like the Mahmud of Ghaznavi, who invaded Somnath 17 times. There comes Sohori. There comes Muhammad bin Qasim, who is from Arabia. And I mean, from our perspective, they are our invaders. And then why should we glorify them like our invaders? Like, why isn't Prithviraj Chauhan our hero and Ghori our villain? Or even like if we go back in history, like that is another argument as well. But like Alexander is still like people still name their kids as Sikandar. But like the guy who fought against Raja Porus against Alexander, nobody even like remembers his name.
Invaders. Now that's an interesting term. How is Mahmud of Ghazni attacking Somnath, or Babur attacking Delhi, any different than any other Indian king attacking another Indian king? That's really not different. We should, I think of invaders as people like Temur, who entered Delhi, who sacked Delhi, who took its wealth back to Samarkand, or the British who came to our country, they developed infrastructure that they needed, they extracted our wealth and took it back to England. But people who came from outside, who ruled, genuinely ruled our region, and then they left a cultural legacy, I don't think of them as any worse than any other king. To sort of think of all of them as our forebearers, not exactly heroes. I don't think that we should think of anybody as heroes, to be honest. But as our people, like Babur is as Indian as, for example, Prithviraj Chauhan is, and Akbar and Alauddin Khilji. All these people, they, for example, Alauddin Khilji, he defended India against the Mongols. If the Mongols had entered what they did in Lahore in, I think, 1230, the stuff that they did there, if they had done that to Delhi, we would have taken 200 years to recover from this. This horrible event. So we should not really call them invaders, or to sort of distinguish. I mean, look at Spain. They genuinely, it was a foreign power that entered of different religion, and then they conquered this region. People died, obviously, during warfare, as people do. But then they gave so much to the region. They embraced the region. They loved the people. The Mughals did the same in India. But yeah, we just think of foreigners as foreigners are somehow worse than other Indians. I mean, how exactly is, for me as a Punjabi, how exactly is being attacked by someone, by a Bengali, different than being attacked by someone from Afghanistan?
No, okay, like let's, for the sake of argument, we say like, okay, someone comes from Sindh, and then there is Raja Dahir, who is defending the Sindhis against a foreign invader who came from Arabia, sent by Hajjaj, his nephew, Muhammad bin Qasim. Do you think his hero should be Muhammad bin Qasim, or it should be Raja Dahir?
Neither. There's really no need for us to have heroes. Do we have need for that?
Is William Wallace not a hero for the Scots?
Why should, well, in his case, it's kind of different. But again, why should we have these heroes? We are totally different people than they were. Our cultures are totally different. To be Sindhi is, back then, my people would have called themselves Sindhi, even though I come from Punjab, because everything has changed. Do we really need to have heroes? We should have heroes in the modern era who have, like, people who were founding fathers of Pakistan or founding fathers of India. We should have these heroes rather than look back so back behind in history and lose the context of the whole situation. Like, exactly, Raja Dahir, you might say that he was defending, but was Raja Dahir not a tyrant? Was it not Indians? Was it not Sindhi? Was it not the Jat who helped Muhammad bin Qasim? Was it not the locals who helped these invaders, who joined their armies, who helped them defeat the locals? There was a lot of nuance, but we lose a lot of context when we look so back into the past.
Okay. I will come back to this one point, like you were saying, like about, we were talking about religion and like Hindustan and Pakistan. So as a Pakistani, if I may ask you, like, how do you identify yourself? Like, what is your identity? Is it like being a Punjabi, your identity? Is it like being a Muslim, or is it like a Pakistan? Because a lot of people talk about that, like over the course of last 70, 75 years, Pakistanis and Pakistan, like, have not been able to produce, like, create a national identity the way India has done.
I was once sitting with a couple of friends, and somebody from Turkey, a friend of mine from Turkey, he entered the room, and I greeted him in Turkish. And there was somebody from France sitting there, and he asked me if we spoke the same language. I said, we don't speak the same language, but I know some terms in Turkish, but we also have some words in common, because, and this is what I said, they ruled us for 300 years. What I meant by that was that they, the Turks, ruled us, the Indians, for 300 years. What I used to say was that we, the Muslims, used to rule them, the Hindus, for 800 years. But I thought about that, and I thought about how recently reading about Indian history has shifted my identity. I identify as a Muslim, a Punjabi, and an Indian. And by Indian, I don't mean the Republic of India. I mean the subcontinent of India, Hindustan, as we call it. That's primarily how I identify. And in terms of Pakistan and India, I do have a Pakistani passport. So like, that is a part of it. But I personally prefer not to identify as that. Like, it's a little bit like anti-patriotic, I mean, whatever the term is, but I prefer not to identify as a Pakistani, because Pakistan does not actually have an identity. We have Punjabis who sort of abandoned their Punjabi identity to create this Pakistani culture, which, you know, we speak Urdu, and you see that in Lahore, Karachi, and Islamabad. But Sindhis and Balochis and Pashtun, they have sort of held on to their identities much more than Punjabis have. So there is a Pakistani culture that's starting to appear, but I don't really identify with it, because I'm from a village in Faisalabad, and so I am much more close to the Punjabi culture than I am to the culture of people from Lahore. And I find them very, whenever I meet someone who speaks Urdu as a first language from Lahore or whatever, I don't really identify with them. I don't really think of them and me as coming from the same place.
Really? Then do you think, what's the reason behind that? Like, if we see now, we have like 57, 58 like Islamic countries, and there is not, I don't know, there's democracy in Turkey, and like the condition it has right now is also like quite debatable. Then there is like a sort of like a theocratic democracy in Iran. Then we have democracy in Pakistan and Bangladesh. Like, do you think like democracy is in like, is it compatible? Like a lot of people talk about that. It's not compatible with like, you know, Islam and like the Muslim mindset or whatever.
No, you can blame the Muslim mindset, but to be honest, has democracy really worked out in India, or other in Africa, in all these countries? Because we're not really, it's not about Muslim mindset, it's about Eastern mindset. Like I mentioned before in the West, people had power, so they sort of, democracy was sort of a natural jump up from that. But in our world, we never had, the people never had any power, so they never really imagined that. So we are used to living in sort of this serfdom, below, in sort of this particular ranks. There's a certain amount of colonial baggage, that's true. But for example, look at South America. The public has been disabused of the idea that they have any will. Whenever they elect a public, if they elect a communist regime, CIA used to overthrow them. CIA used to overthrow elected governments. They did that all over the South America. France did that all over Africa. So we do have a certain amount of colonial imperialism alive as well. But also, I think democracy, it's actually not a very good thing. But the reason that it exists so strongly in the Western people, they always think, they sort of think that they have sort of this higher civilization than we do, which is ruled by the law and everybody's equal and they trust the government. But that's not actually true. How would you replicate the Western model somewhere? How would you do that? How would you build trust among, if this went wrong, how would you build trust again? The trust that everything stands on was bought by colonial money, by American gold, by African wealth, all of these things. They built empire. When they run out of money, when now, for example, with the Russian invasion, I think that when they run out of money, or when these things start to dwindle, when German public transport system and education system starts to dwindle, when their healthcare system starts to dwindle, they're going to reveal exactly how hollow democracy actually is. And look at France. I think something like 92% of the people who voted for Macron in this election, they didn't vote for him. They voted against Marine Le Pen. Is that really democracy? What is that exactly? And so,
Okay, now I'm getting a bit of an idea of like your an understanding of like your idea of like, you know, you're talking about democracy, and then there's I can see that that burst of Marx, which is like right behind you.
Very, very much so. Like I said, like 1984, he mentions about the use of language, and I really have started to focus on the fact that the language is very important. First of all, Russia has been cultivated as the great Western villain for the last 500 years, pretty much since the time of Ivan the Terrible. And every single time you have Russophobia at a ridiculous level, and so now its invasion has been this has been done. Similarly, Iran has been vilified. Even SNL back in, I think John Ghaznavanian mentioned that once back in 1979 when they overthrew the Shah, SNL made sketches making fun of dehumanizing Iranians, and so there's like propaganda. It's a ridiculous amount of propaganda that's done, that's painted. Now people were actually, the reason behind this so much outrage with Ukraine was, first of all, with Russia. Russia is the great European villain, but also because Ukrainians are white, and there was like relatively civilized and blue-eyed and blonde, and yeah, but Ukraine is sort of the peaceful. But when the same thing happened to blue-eyed blonde Muslims in Bosnia, no one said anything, because the Balkans, they see that as this destabilized region. Like, this happens there, it's like, what else is new? But with Ukraine, they were shocked. So yeah, media and language play a very important role. You call it invasion, like, you know, intervention. With when the US attacks someone, it's because the US is protecting its interests. But when the Russians do something, it's a blatant human rights violation, in the shape of a war and all that. You know, the same thing they did in Iraq. The US did that. They tortured people. They tortured the Taliban to get force them to tell them to say that Iraq was responsible for training the Taliban, something that was totally, completely untrue. And Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney used that as an excuse to invade a perfectly simple country that had nothing to do with anything, but they invaded that. And it's the same thing. How is that any different? Even Bush recently confused that. He said something about that.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Okay, not to take away anything from the people of Ukraine. They are the only people like who are oppressed in this conflict. So, it's the war of like Russia and the West, but like the people of Ukraine, like my sympathies and our sympathies are with them. Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity and time, Suresh. It was lovely. I quite much enjoyed talking to you. Hopefully I would love to like invite you again later on at some point to the podcast, and thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. It was really nice talking to you.
Okay.